Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, back from our trip to downstate Illinois. We had a lovely time there at WILL in Champaign, Urbana. But, you know, I'm sure you're not going to thank me for having you listen to this bit of sound right now. Some of you may recognize it. In 40 years, that's right, 40 years, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie has made $30 million on its original investment of $300,000. That's a much better return than, say, the bond market. We're going to talk about both the legendary horror flick and a legendary bond trader who is scaring some investors these days. We'll also explore just how hard it is for families to actually put home-cooked meals on their tables each night. As important as it might be for health, low- and middle-income families are finding a lot of obstacles to making beef stew, roast chicken, lasagna, and the like. But we begin with a look at the first case of Ebola virus right here in the United States, a man who traveled from Liberia to visit relatives in Dallas, Texas. He landed in the United States on September 20th and started developing symptoms a few days later. He's now being treated at the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, and the Centers for Disease Control has dispatched a team. Where did this man go? Who did he talk to? Who did he touch, hug, kiss? Think about it. What could happen to an Ebola carrier in 4, 5, or 6 days?
The bottom line here is that I have no doubt that we will control this importation or this case of Ebola so that it does not spread widely in this country. It is certainly possible that someone who had contact with this individual, a family member or other individual, could develop Ebola in the coming weeks. But there is no doubt in my mind that we will stop it here.
It's Dr. Tom Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reassuring the public in a national news conference yesterday. Joining us now is Laurie Garrett, senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Laurie.
Hi, John.
So this scenario here, someone traveling from West Africa, an infected zone to the United States, this is a scenario you've explored quite a lot in your writings and research. How alarming is it, or are you as reassured as Tom Frieden seems to be here?
Well, I think we all knew this was going to happen eventually. And as this epidemic continues to spread out of control in West Africa, it's inevitable that there will be individuals who travel not knowing they're carrying the virus, not just to the United States, but many other places in the world. But I think we've been prepared for this. And I think that, you know, the whole state of Texas, their entire health apparatus is mobilized to tackle the problem.
And let's talk a little bit about the news conferences yesterday. I'm sure you watched them, as did I, both in Dallas and in Atlanta there, Tom Frieden at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There was a lot of talk about privacy in Texas and the HIPAA rules. I'm wondering if a concern about privacy, and I have a concern about privacy, I know you do as well, if that gets in the way of investigators trying to see who has been talked to, who has been touched, who has been contacted here. Are they competing interests in an investigation like this?
I don't think so, because the privacy gets waived for the sake of the investigation. They simply cannot reveal the information to anybody else outside of the circle of investigators.
So the privacy and HIPAA is not going to make a problem for investigators there in Dallas as they look at where this person has gone?
No, the state authorities have the ability to override it for the sake of the investigation.
Let's talk about transportation infrastructure. Does anyone have responsibility for creating rules for who travels when, why, how you test people? Does it vary from airline to airline, country to country, city to city?
Depends on the situation. In this situation, most airlines have been informed, certainly in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, but all over in various countries around the world, been informed that you have to do fever checks on individuals before they board the planes. I've certainly been in situations, since I go to epidemics all the time, where individuals have been required to fill out a health form or submit to a thermometer check. This is often a routine procedure before boarding. And then many airlines have the legal right to, depending on what country you're in, to say to an individual, you do not appear to be well. We're asking you to leave the flight. This, of course, is before you take off. And airlines can request and do, in some cases, that a seemingly ill individual be isolated in a part of the plane where there are not other people sitting near them.
Now, based on your understanding of this situation, again, we don't know very much at all for a whole variety of reasons. Do you think this individual behaved responsibly in that he understood he was coming from a zone where there was this infection, had some symptoms, voluntarily showed up at a hospital twice, it seems? Is this a person acting recklessly or acting responsibly in your view?
Oh, I think this individual is very responsible, apparently. First of all, he had no symptoms at all when he left Liberia. He was completely well for several days, had no reason to believe that he was a carrier of the disease. As soon as he felt symptoms, he notified hospital. He went to the hospital, but they made a diagnosis that sent him home with antibiotics. He apparently, I mean, I have talked to many, many physicians working all over the United States who tell me that it is now so routine because of concerns about Ebola that travel histories are taken on every single patient coming into emergency rooms now, that it's actually slowing down the intake time in the ER, in hospital after hospital across the country. A lot of physicians are actually starting to say they refuse to treat or process lab samples from individuals that have traveled recently from Western Africa. So I don't think that we're looking at a situation, and I believe the public should be very calm. I don't think we're looking at a situation where either this particular individual or any other traveler is going to sneak through a system and infect a huge number of people inside the United States.
That's great information. Lori Garrett, thanks so much.
You bet.
Lori Garrett is Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Doesn't have to happen. That's the thing. We could really stop this epidemic. We could have stopped this epidemic. We can still stop this epidemic. We try hard enough. All these people don't have to die.
September 26th. Hope and frustration from Dr. Adam Levine in Bong County, Liberia. The ER doctor from Rhode Island is volunteering with the International Medical Corps, and he's been allowing us to see the Ebola crisis through his eyes, taking us to his clinics.
So just after dawn, while waiting for the morning shift to come in, I went to say goodbye, actually, to the last few patients. I wandered down the little dirt path that goes through the forest from the ETU, past the hanging vines and beneath the trees to our little cemetery, just in a clearing in the woods. And went down to where the five little graves were lined up with two more empty ones that were waiting for the two latest patients to be buried later today. And got a chance to say goodbye to Dada and Remy and Mohammed and Matthew and Anna.
It's emotional these days for Dr. Levine. He will soon be going home. Among the unfinished business is the condition of his good friend and operating room nurse named Comfort. We learned last week that Comfort is infected and has been touch and go, but it looks like she's going to pull through.
It's my last shift in the Ebola treatment unit here in Bong County, and I just rounded in the high-risk zone of our treatment unit for the last time. We had two more deaths yesterday, which brings our total to seven deaths since we opened about 10 days ago. I got the chance to say goodbye to some of those patients that I've been seeing every day for the last couple weeks, including Comfort, who is doing much better. In fact, she's almost completely symptom-free at this point.
Dr. Levine knows he's leaving a lot behind as he returns to Rhode Island. His colleagues in Liberia baked him a cake to say goodbye.
You know, we had a funny little back and forth where they were so thankful for me for coming here and said I was a hero. And then I said, no, you're the heroes because I'm going back home and you're going to continue working here day in and day out, fighting Ebola and, you know, helping your fellow Liberians. And it's true, they have a much harder job than I do. Many of them, in fact, you know, are being ostracized by their communities for working here in the Ebola treatment unit. Some we actually have to provide housing for because their communities won't let them live there because they're working here in our Ebola treatment unit. So there's just so much stigma associated with the disease, and you know, the fact that these healthcare workers, many of whom have colleagues who've fallen ill or died from the disease, are still here working is really impressive.
September 26th, 2014, one of the last days on the ground for Dr. Adam Levine, Rhode Island Hospital emergency physician and a volunteer for the International Medical Corps. We want to thank Dr. Levine for filing these audio diaries for us. I suspect the people of Liberia want to thank him for so much more. In the Bond game, there's only one name, Gross, Bill Gross, the founder of PIMCO, the largest bond fund in the world. But a shakeup at PIMCO over the last year, including the departure of PIMCO exec Mohammed El Arian and now Bill Gross himself, has caused serious rumblings among bondholders. Tens of billions of dollars are now either running to find safety in all this turmoil or chasing Wizard Bill Gross to his new gig at the Janus Fund. It's all causing ripples in markets that determine the wealth of pension funds, university endowments, hedge funds, and all kinds of other pillars in the global economy. Joining us is Heidi Moore, finance and economics editor for The Guardian US. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So we said we were very enthusiastic about talking about bonds, and you were worried that we were ill.
I was worried. Not a lot of people tend to be fascinated by bonds. In fact, usually it's an excuse to end the conversation, but I'm perfectly happy to talk about them.
Well, a lot of the financial channels are really obsessed with Bill Gross. The Wall Street Journal did this whole thing about how Allianz, the holder of PIMCO, may lose $400 billion of departures, of outflows. The question occurred to me, is the bond market okay? Because if it's not, that's scary.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the bond market. So for the past 30 years, the bond market has been a wonderful way to make money. And a lot of people don't really understand bonds, but they're very easy to understand. Whenever somebody buys a bond, you're lending the government or a company money. So when you buy a treasury bond, you're lending the government money and they're paying you interest. When you buy a corporate bond, it's the same thing. Most of us don't own bonds. We own them through mutual funds. So Bill Gross ran a giant mutual fund at PIMCO, and he essentially made investing in bonds part of the mutual fund market. And so it has been incredibly profitable for so long that right now we're in this period of really, really low interest rates, zero interest rates. And you've seen that in your savings account. And low interest rates aren't good for bonds because when you buy a bond, you want the interest rate actually to fall. And right now, interest rates are at zero, so they're not going to fall anymore. So it makes it very hard to sell bonds, which makes it a difficult market for a lot of bond managers.
And PIMCO hasn't done terribly well. Gross is responsible for that. And so there's been a lot of grumbling about PIMCO's performance. But there's also this second question, and that is he's got this reputation as being a wizard. If he suddenly, you know, runs over to Janus and starts this tiny little fund, people think, oh, he's a genius and he's going to do some sort of magic. That's a really disruptive impact on the market. The bond market is not used to this kind of flamboyance, is it?
It's actually not, at least on a very public level, and it's caused some worries. I mean, for people to understand who Bill Gross is, he's essentially the Colossus of Rhodes. He's one of the seven wonders of the world of bond investing. And so for him to be kicked out of the firm that he founded is a huge scandal in the bond world. And the reason that he has this outsized reputation is because he is somebody who managed to make so much money for investors for so long. He was legendary. But what his reputation has covered over the past few years is that as interest rates have fallen, he has returned less. He's struggled with performance, but people still regard him as a legend. You don't write off a legend for a few bad years. But that has continued, and unfortunately, it also dovetailed with some difficulties. He's an outsized polarized personality, and that created some difficulties with the people he worked with. For instance, he had a rule you couldn't talk to him before he had had coffee. And so it made him quite a presence in the office. And those two things dovetailed, the low returns plus the conflicts with his coworkers, and now he's out. But he had suffered outflows for quite some time, and it was just because he was such a legend that people looked past it.
Does this indicate a lack of demand for bonds? If you have a pension fund, do you want to look and see if these outflows have affected the wealth of your fund? Can you have an impact in your own portfolio because of what's going on here, even if you don't follow someone like Bill Gross?
If you don't follow somebody like Bill Gross, and if you don't have money in PIMCO, you probably don't need to be so worried, because the bond market is enormous. It is many, many times the size of the stock market. But you know what's been going on in the bond market over the past, I want to say, 6 years since the financial crisis, is that the Federal Reserve has tried to convince pension funds and mutual funds to buy different kinds of bonds. So they'd been buying treasury bonds, and the Federal Reserve said, "We'll buy those treasury bonds. We'll buy mortgage bonds," which we all know about from the crisis, so that you go ahead and buy company bonds and help drive corporate America that way and potentially help drive hiring. And so it's not so much that the bond market is in trouble. It's what kinds of bonds are we talking about? So the bond market is doing fine. It's just you can't make as much money in it. And so the people whose job it is to figure out how to make money in that market are having a tough time. But that has nothing to do with PIMCO or with Bill Gross.
But the chain that you've described there is actually really key to the economy. If for some reason the problems with treasury bonds and mortgage bonds make it difficult for corporations to get cash by selling their own bonds, then you really have a problem in corporate America, right?
Yes, you would have that problem. Right now, it is almost the opposite problem, right? It is a boom market. It's so booming that people are buying the bonds of companies who have essentially subprime credit scores. So these are big companies. You know them well. But, you know, they have what's called junk bonds, right? And it means that they have a higher chance of not being able to pay back their investors.
So they have a higher interest rate.
Yes, exactly. They have a higher interest rate and a higher chance of defaulting. They're called high yield bonds. And the reason for that is that high yield is part of the Wall Street rubric that means high risk means high return. So right now, those bonds are doing very well. But the risk with them, as always, is that if the economy turns and those companies can't make money, they can't pay back their investors. And so people are worried about a crash in those particular kinds of, let's call them, subprime corporate bonds.
Subprime corporate bond bubble. That may be the next thing we're talking about.
Yes, it would be called high yield, so that's what you want to look for. But it may not happen. I mean, corporate America has a way of solving its own problems because it can renegotiate contracts in a way that consumers can't.
Heidi Moore is finance and economics editor for The Guardian U.S. Nothing beats a chainsaw in the fall. In the annals of gory violence, do-it-yourself property maintenance, and just raw human machine power, there is nothing like a chainsaw. And back in 1974, the chainsaw went to the movies. Low-budget horror meets power tool commercial. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the standard for worst-case scenario. Your car runs out of gas on a highway outside of Lubbock, and there's just one gas station over there that looks abandoned. Hey, is there anyone there?
Sally, I hear something. Stop! Stop!
Yeah, the original TCM cost $300K to make and has pulled in $30 million, and that doesn't even count all of the spin-offs and gory imitators. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the perfect movie date, right? Here's Movie Date podcast host Kristen Meinzer. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, John, and happy 40th birthday, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
This is a movie phenomenon.
Gosh, and a nightmare maker.
And what would you say the significance of Texas Chainsaw Massacre is 40 years on?
Well, I mean, it really put in place the slasher film, the faceless guy who's coming after you, the use of power tools, which wasn't very common back then. I just rewatched it last night in the name of good journalism.
Of course.
And of course, I had to sleep with the lights on all night. It's a terrifying movie, and it was banned in a number of countries. For years, you couldn't see it in England. And even though it's considered such a gore fest, rewatching it last night, I saw there wasn't actually that much gore. It's just the idea of things, the cannibalism, being killed with chainsaws, having furniture in your house made out of human bodies, all that.
What brand of chainsaw is used in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Did you happen to notice that?
I didn't notice, but I can say this. Behind the scenes, all the actors revealed the chainsaws actually were operating at all times. That's not special effects. It's not noise that's put on in post. But they were actually running through the woods with chainsaws and having those chainsaws next to their faces.
You know, the fun fact here that I didn't really realize is that this movie and so many of the horror movies, the real slasher gore movies, are based on a single incident, a Jeffrey Dahmer-like incident from, what is it, the 1960s?
Ed Gein from the 1950s, from America's Heartland, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And he actually did have furniture and other objects made out of humans. And he was a serial killer. And Silence of the Lambs, other films have, Psycho, they all found their inspiration in Ed Gein. But what a lot of people don't realize is that Texas Chainsaw Massacre also was inspired by the Houston murders. There were these mass murders that were happening back then. And the people who were responsible for that, Dean Corll, a.k.a. the Candyman, Elmer Wayne Henley, right around the time Texas Chainsaw Massacre was being developed, those murders were being uncovered.
How many sequels? How many?
Well, if we count prequels,
right,
sequels, remakes, and so on, there have been about half a dozen. And there were also, in the early 80s, there was also a video game, which did horribly because most video game stores would not carry
really?
This video game because you're playing Leatherface. You're playing the killer. You're not trying to survive. You're actually trying to get people with your chainsaw.
And is the franchise Saw based on Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Or is that something fundamentally different?
There is inspiration there, but Saw, some people say Saw is more politically minded. For example, one of the more recent Saw movies, they punish people for doing bad things. And in one, it was insurance people, which I thought was pretty great.
Ever used a chainsaw? You're from the Midwest.
I have not used a chainsaw. I have used a weed whacker, and I would love it if weed whackers were more commonly used in horror movies because I think of all the different types of lawn appliances, I think weed whackers. I mean, have you ever used a weed whacker?
The Minnesota Weed Whacker Massacre starring Kristen Meinzer.
That versus the leaf
blower? That's kind of an evil
that's
laugh.
That's just dangerous.
That's kind of an evil laugh. I don't know.
Also, one more thing I want to point out about this movie. A lot of people think it's based on a true story because in the opening of the film, they actually say this is based on a true story. It's John Larroquette's voice saying that, but it's not based on a true story. Just some inspiration here and there from real stories.
Well, thanks for setting us straight on that. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast on the 40th anniversary of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Thanks, John.
A family tradition out of reach? Home cooking. Think about it. By the time you shop and then bring stuff home, find the recipe, set out the ingredients, cook it all up, time it so everyone will be home when the food is ready, a home-cooked meal can seem like a complicated mission of the Navy SEALs.
2 minutes! You don't make it, you do it again!
Have you been tested this hard ever in your life?
Never.
Flour! Whole wheat flour!
Winning here is a conscious decision.
Get those chicken breasts! I need those chicken breasts now!
You just proved to your bodies, through your mind...
Wash that lettuce! Wash that lettuce!
...that you can push yourself further than you thought possible.
Go, go, go! Pickles, 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 carrots!
Go get wet! Run!
Asparagus does not cook itself!
You sure you want to be here?
Yes, I do!
Are you absolutely sure?
I'm positive!
All right, we're exaggerating with that Lone Survivor soundtrack there, but is a home-cooked meal too much work for a busy, working, low-to-middle-income family?
Hi, this is Andrew from Honolulu, Hawaii. In our house, the term home-cooked no longer really means what it used to mean. We try to cook at home pretty much as often as possible, multiple times a week, but it's very rare that home-cooked means home-cooked. We are really just heating up pre-cooked foods that we bought at the store. It's nothing like when we were kids and mom would cook home-cooked meals. Oh, well.
Oh, well, Andrew, thanks so much for reaching out. Here's Samantha from Macon, Georgia. Once a week, if I'm lucky, she says. I live by myself and work two jobs, so it's hard to find time, especially time to shop for food and then cook it. How much of a challenge is this for all of us, whether our income is high or low? A team of sociologists at North Carolina State University studied hundreds of low and middle income families trying to cook meals from scratch and found they experienced significant stress, didn't save money, and faced impossible schedules juggling work and kids. Joining me now, Sarah Bowen, a researcher on the study and associate professor of sociology at North Carolina State University. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thank you.
So we certainly made much of the drama of a home-cooked meal. What did you find in studying the many families that you looked at?
Well, we did find that the majority of the families that we interviewed were cooking most nights per week. On average, they were cooking 5 nights a week, and a lot of families were cooking more, either because they couldn't afford to eat out or because they felt it was important to be able to eat at home. But it was almost impossible for the poor families to enact this ideal of what an ideal home-cooked meal is for different reasons, because of money and time and other obstacles. And for the middle-class families, they were spending a lot of time reading literature on the best foods and trading recipes and cooking these meals, but they were also... they felt stressed and frustrated about not living up to the ideal of the ideal home-cooked meal.
How did that stress express itself in your research?
Well, for the middle-class moms who were the ones that were, you know, they had read all of these messages that we need to cook at home and that's the way we're going to have healthy kids and healthy families by making everything from scratch. So they were really trying hard to do this, but most of them worked, and they often did have a partner at home to help them, but still everybody's getting home at 6, and they're scrambling to get dinner on the table while the kids run around. And all of the families we interviewed also did have young children, which I think is important. And so they felt conflicted between wanting to spend time with their kids and enjoy their families and wanting to make these meals, and it was just, it was difficult.
Did you think that for the sample group, in many cases, the ideal of a home-cooked meal was really outmoded, was maybe not worth its apparent value?
Well, I think for a lot of the moms that we talked to, you know, a lot of them talked about how they liked cooking in theory. They liked caring for their family in that way, and they liked being creative in the kitchen. But in the article, we talk about a lot of the things that got in the way of how that worked day in and day out. So it was worth it to them to cook for their families, but because of money and time and also the stress of pleasing others, multiple family members, and not everyone being home at the same time, this sometimes got in the way of what we think of when we think of what dinner at home should look like.
Sarah Bowen, I'm surprised that the dads weren't helping more in this day and age. It seems like moms are doing most of the work in your study.
In our study, the moms were doing the majority of the cooking work. There were a lot of families where the dads did help. But if you look at national time use studies, men do cook a lot more than they did in the 60s. But women still do more of the cooking work. So one of the things that we emphasize in our paper is that although men are an important part of this, women still do a lot of the cooking work. So sometimes when we tell people, you know, we need to cook more, that's what we need for healthy families, that burden can disproportionately be placed on women, even unintentionally.
It sounds like there is a lot of work that can be done to help families trying to accomplish this.
We think so. We think that sharing the work of cooking is part of it. And another part of it is addressing some of these broader inequalities that underlie this. So the poor families really had, it was very difficult for them to meet the ideal because they worked non-standard work schedules, because they had, you know, they had to work two jobs to be able to stay afloat. And so part of making it possible for everyone to get these home-cooked meals involves dealing with things like wages and work schedules and food environments, making sure people have access to stores where they can shop that are relatively close by, so that everyone has the option of being able to enjoy food with their families.
What are you having for dinner tonight, Sarah?
I haven't thought that far ahead.
Well, here's wishing you and your family a stress-free home-cooked meal this evening.
Thank you.
Sarah Bowen is Associate Professor of Sociology at North Carolina State University.
Hi, this is Lisa from South Carolina, and a home-cooked meal is a luxury we can't afford. Our crazy schedule doesn't allow for it, and when I do cook, the kids think that my cooking does not taste as good as the fast food that they're used to getting. So we need to plan meals as a family, and we need to sit down and have meals as a family together to break our cycle of the fast food.
Hey, this is Caroline from Augusta, Georgia, and I have found that the easiest way to make meals quick and easy is to think of it as a meat and specific veggies or sides. And so once I prepare, you know, garlic chicken and a couple veggies, it just seems to come together a lot quicker.
Poor Greenville, South Carolina. Almost never. Our stove died, and we haven't had the cash to buy another one. I have a combo deep fryer, rice cooker, stew pot, but about four nights a week, it's fast food. Need a tip?
By far, my most important tip is to not be too ambitious. I think it's very important to just have a couple of recipes in your back pocket that you can make on autopilot with no recipe, you know, just roast a chicken or bake sausages with apples. Because I think if you're too ambitious, if you're whipping up, you know, osso buco on a Tuesday night, then that usually means you're going to be using a lot of pans. And if there's a lot of pots and pans, you're going to be doing a lot of cleaning up. And if there's a lot of cleaning up, that means you are probably less likely to do it all again the next night. So it's the long game here we're after. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So just pace yourself psychologically and cook good, simple food.
Our thanks to Jenny Rosenstrack, who recently wrote the New York Times series Dinner, the Boot Camp on the Motherlode blog. You can find a full list of Lori's tips on our website at thetakeaway.org, where you can, of course, comment on anything you've heard in the program. And I have to set the record straight before we go. The ghost of musician John Hartford tapped many of you on the shoulder yesterday when I mistakenly said the song Gentle on My Mind was written by Glen Campbell. Well, the outrage was immediate and intense. I have no excuse for getting that one wrong. Poor Tom said he almost drove off the road when he heard the Hartford slight. John Hartford wrote the song Gentle on My Mind. Campbell just made it a hit.
That keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. That keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
Sorry, guys. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns now that binds me.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.